Hello and welcome to another episode of Wind and Wave Surf Talk. Today we've got a great show lined up for you. We've got Brian Reardon from the Auxiliary Channel on the phone. And Brian is coincidentally good friends with Kevin Wormsley from the shop. Kevin and Brian grew up in Marshfield, Massachusetts, surfing together. And then Brian went on to launch a video streaming company called the Auxiliary Channel. And Brian has done an amazing job covering all kinds of live action sports events and providing a streaming service so that all of us at home can be watching on our laptops and televisions and so on through the internet. So he does a nice job of taking us all the way back to the beginning, sort of the infancy of streaming video, back when all of us were probably on dial-ups and so on and really frustrated with the video quality that could be produced back then. But like all things in technology, things advance real quickly, and Brian does a nice job of staying with the pace, and has created a nice, a great little business that's responsible for really providing some amazing content for all of us. So Brian, most recently, Brian covered the 2016 Pacific Paddle Games down in Doheny Beach. And it was nice. I was actually on the beach to watch that event for that weekend. And Brian and his team did an amazing job covering all the action. And incidentally, he also did the 2015 Paddle Games as well. So he talks a little bit about, you know, just the experience of setting up for an event like that and all the mechanics that are involved in you know, placing different cameras and directing the shoot and so forth. And then he goes back a little bit to talk about some of the experiences that he's had working for the former ASP, the Association of Surfing Professionals. And specifically, Brian and his crew provided the live stream for the now famous 2012 Cloudbreak event. So if you remember back then, that was the year that Cloudbreak had just the epic, enormous swell that actually was so big they had to cancel. They had to cancel the professional tour event, and that's when all the big wave guys were there. Fortunately, they were there to be able to get in the water and start and ride these the massive swell from that day. And what was great is, you know, Brian and his team were already obviously all set up to cover the event. And so they just kept the cameras rolling and captured some of the most amazing big wave surfing that you can see on the internet today. So I think that you'll really enjoy this show. It's a really great perspective. Brian has a lot of energy, and you can tell, you know, when you listen to him talk, that he's a guy who's really kind of found his passion. He loves his work. And it really shows in the kind of work that they're producing. And I think we all can say how grateful we are for guys like Brian allowing us to be able to watch these events halfway around the world through streaming media as well or better than even the major sports networks. So thanks, Brian. And so that's that. So again, thanks for tuning in. Hope you enjoy the show. Be sure to check us out online at windandwaves.com.
Awesome. I'm honored to be here. You guys are amazing.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Brian. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. These are a lot of fun. So, and, you know, when we dreamed up this idea, Kevin and I sat down quickly and came up with a list of names of people that we definitely wanted to call, and you were high on that list. So thanks for taking time out today to do this.
Oh, no problem at all. It's an honor. Thank you very much.
So I thought we'd just start, if you could quickly, just for listeners who don't know who you are or what you do, if you could give us a quick rundown on sort of what you're doing in the water sports world and, a little bit about how you got started and we'll take it from there.
Sounds good. I guess the primary function of my business is to live stream sports that, you know, that we love, the water sports, and would otherwise not get coverage like this on television. We're trying to bridge the gap between lives or internet and TV. So we have this production that is, you guys are all familiar with, multiple cameras, replays, graphics, and the whole, you know, announcers and wireless cameras, boat angles, everything like that, that you would see on a high-end TV production that's covering something on ESPN. We're trying to replicate that in a cost-effective way so all these companies can get their brand out there to the world via their computers and now their, you know, their devices, phones, tablets. And a lot of our broadcasts are going straight to TV now. So we kind of saw the future of what media is and embrace that. And that's what we offer to our clients. And it's not just surfing, but, you know, I do have a lot of surfing on the books because of my background, but we're branching out, and I mean, we do everything from surfing to corporate stuff too. So, but in the water world, that's, you know, a lot of our background is from the water world and, just growing up surfing on the East Coast and having the board sports love is where my roots were, and I'm really, really fortunate and blessed to have followed that passion through to the profession that I do now, because not too many people get to do that, I don't think. And to be able to work in something that I've been familiar with since I was a child is an absolute blessing. And we're definitely branching out into other sports, but I'm trying not to go too far. I'm trying to keep it centered.
Right. So Brian, how did you in particular get into filming? Like, were you a young kid who had, you know, who was like filming friends, doing stuff for a long time? I mean, because it's one thing to get out there and be surfing every day, but it's another thing to sort of have the wherewithal to think about, hey, it would be great to be recording this and somebody's got to capture some video and it'd be great if we could put together an edit and so forth. But, you know, before the internet really kind of blew up, there was a lot of people doing their own self-promotional videos. And were you one of those guys?
I was. We were always, you know, filming in late in the high school, and then in college it became a real passion. we used to, you know, we were more all about photos because we could afford a little point-and-shoot camera. And then those little cameras started recording video. And I don't remember when that was, sometime in the mid-90s when those little, it's like the size, you know those little digital cameras that were like the size of a deck of cards?
Yep.
Those things started recording video, and that's when I learned how to edit. And when I went to college up in Vermont at St. Michael's, and the snowboarding scene was something that I always embraced but never really had like a culture around besides like Kevin and I, snowboarding, a couple friends. So when I got to college and all these new friends were snowboarding, we were snowboarding all the time, and we ended up just filming everything. I got a video camera. It was like a Sony Hi8, tape deck video camera. And we would go to Stowe, and we were filming all the time. And I just ended up being the guy that always had the camera in his hand. I liked filming. And then I got really good at it. So whenever somebody wanted to do something that was risky, they were like, well, give it to Brian because he's going to definitely get the shot. So by default, I just became the guy who always had the camera in his hand and then learned how to edit. And then when we graduated college, we started producing snowboarding movies. And we were doing this with one camera. I was shooting, and, you know, I'd hand the camera off to somebody if I was going to go off a cliff or something like that. But between 2003 and 2006, we produced four full-length snowboarding movies and released them and, you know, had 9 or 10 guys in the movie. And it was a year-long process to produce that. And it became very difficult to justify those. It became very difficult to justify producing those videos because they weren't producing any money. And we were like, all right, we're treading water here. And it was a very saturated market. So we were going to the sponsors and saying, hey, you know, your guys are in this movie. You got to pay for us to film them all year, go in the backcountry, go snowmobiling, and take these risks and bring back this footage and promote your people and your products. And they were at the point where they started advertising online. And they were like, well, this is kind of a, you know, we're not really advertising in this avenue anymore. Unless you were MacDog, Standard Films, or, you know, now Brain Farm, right, you weren't getting any money. You were just producing videos with your friends, and it was enjoyable. And we loved it. But as we got older, we were like, okay, this isn't going to be a viable thing in the future. It's a saturated market. I remember the last year we put out a video, I think it was 2007 or 6, and there was 52 video releases that year. Wow. Titled video releases that had DVD production. So we got together with a couple of friends and said, what can we do to stay in the industry that we're in, but move into something that is valuable to these businesses so that we can continue to work in the industry we love? And we all thought, for sure, it's got to be the internet. So we came up with a plan, a business plan, and raised some money and started a website. And that website was called RealComp. And that was a surf, skate, snow website, like a YouTube, based around submitting videos and competition for those videos with prizes attached to it. So there was a week of submission where people would submit their videos for, say, a best trick or biggest drop or biggest slam or best line or whatever the prerequisite was for that week. And then there was a week of voting. And this website actually gained traction, and we got up to, I think we had 30,000 dedicated followers, and it was really doing pretty well. And one of the aspects of that website was that we were doing live delivery. And I was in charge of the live delivery, and it was very, very, very basic. We would go to an event that never had a live webcast streamed, and I would just approach them and say, hey, we're going to webcast your event, and we're going to do it for free because we have sponsors that will pay for it.
Nice.
So that was the model, because we would approach these companies about doing a live webcast for their event, and they had no idea what it was, and they thought it was a complete waste of time. And, I mean, that's changed from me. I mean, I can look back at my business proposals from 2007 and 8, and I am pitching the idea of a webcast to the company in all these proposals. Now that has gone away completely. They're coming to us and asking for it. So, I mean, we were at the forefront of when surfing was doing this, and surfing really pushed webcasting because they were the first. I mean, they beat any other mainstream sport to the web. And I know the story how it started. Way back, I don't want to say the exact date, but I want to say 1992. The guys that created Beach Bite, his name's Mono, he started streaming the data from the heats, and people would watch their computer screen, and they would watch the numbers change in real time. Well, you know, with a slight delay, a couple seconds delay, but when a heat got out, you could see those four guys' results, and he was streaming that, just that data, that heat data, for a couple years. And then they saw the numbers going up, and they were like, wow, there's thousands of people just watching the screen to see if when the numbers are going to change, to see who won a heat. So I think it was 97 or 6 is when he tried to stream video, and I'm sure the first, you know, couple times they tried it, it was what I call digibarf and just complete garbage video that was barely decipherable, but they did it, you know, and it was probably a single camera with no director, just video feed, and that's how it started. So, in, you know, come 2007, when surfing was doing very good productions at that point, they were pretty good, and a really solid group of guys that I work with a lot that pushed surfing's broadcast to the level that it is today is Uncle Toad's Media Group, UTMG. I got to give them a lot of credit for where I am now. They ran the Triple Crown for 10 years until, you know, the WSL took it over recently. And they still consult with them, and actually it's them behind the scenes that are still running that event. But those guys brought the production from a couple cameras being switched to a whole nother level. Pre-produced content, storyline, very, very high talent with the announcing team. I mean, just the pre-shows, post-shows, super slow-mo cameras, water angles, everything that you see now, they pushed that to the level that it is today. And we saw the Triple Crown in 2007 and 2008, and we were like, we need to bring that to surfing or to snowboarding and skateboarding and all these other sports that we love to do. All these other board sports aren't doing it. They weren't doing it at all. So we approached skateboard company S in 2008 and just, you know, said, hey, we're gonna webcast the S game of skate. And the guy that was in charge of the company at the time, Mark Waters at Soul Technologies, was like, you're gonna do what? He had just had no idea. So we went to the ASR trade show in San Diego and webcast the S Game of Skate, and that was the first webcast we ever did, and it's still on YouTube. A lot of the videos, we broke it up into different battles between the different riders, and there's millions and millions of views on those videos. It's wild. I had a friend that went to St. Michael's College with me. His name's Will Graham, and when he graduated, he was one of the lucky ones that got pulled straight out of college right into a full-time job. And he got hired by Volcom to do back-end and flash development for their website and all sorts of digital media tasks.
Wow.
And after the first year that he was working there, he called us and he was like, hey, you know, Bri, we're doing this webcast. We did a webcast last year for the surf event that we do. It's, you know, the Volcom, the VQS is what they call it. They called it then. Now it's called the TCT, the Totally Crustaceous Tour Championships, which is, you know, it culminates around their year-long tour. It's a global series. Great guy runs it. RJ Dunzelman at Volcom runs it, and he's been running it for a long time. It's just, it's a regional series, and there's competitions all over the world. And then this is the final event where everyone who podiumed at all those events get to come to California, and they have a three-day event on the beach, and it's a blast. So they've been doing that event for a long time, and they started webcasting it in 2007. And in 2008, Will called us and was like, we are struggling. Our webcast is terrible. You need to come help us out. So I got to give it up to Will for getting me that opportunity. I've now done that webcast for Volcom 10 years. This wow. Last June was our 10th anniversary with them. So the first one was 54th Street in Newport Beach, and it's now moved to Lowers. And it's just, since they moved it to Lowers 2 years ago, it's just, it's insane now. It's just the level of riding that wave offers is, it's awesome. So Volcom is, you know, a huge part of my heritage and a large reason why I got involved with surfing.
So, wow.
As far as
production
goes, yeah.
Wow, that's a great little timeline in terms of the history of webcasting. And, you know, we were talking about this earlier, but before our call, but yeah, one of the things that's really interesting about what you do, and it's, as you stated so eloquently, is you guys fill this gap, you know, between, for these niche sports that are relatively too small to be covered by major sports networks. I think that example of that initial sort of live feed of scores that were being posted and the amount of eyeballs that were on those screens just to see the numbers change gave plenty of people enough evidence to show that there's a huge population of people that's interested in this. And so knowing that you had the audience, it was only a matter of time before, I guess, technology could really catch up and make this possible. So, I mean, one of the questions that we had was, you know, you kind of had to, this whole service had to grow sort of in lockstep with internet technology and specifically internet bandwidth, right? So in those early days when you were talking about just how terrible the video quality looked like initially, how did you guys sort of figure out, or how did you get around some of the challenges of, you know, of simultaneous users, of you know, thousands of users all trying to watch the same content at once? And, you know, what were kind of, without getting into the technology necessarily, but what was the growth like, or the growth challenges of setting up all these cameras, having the feeds ready to go, and then basically not having the bandwidth or the pipe big enough to be able to send it out to the internet?
That's a really great question, Russ. Back in the day when we would lose the internet during a webcast, we would just be like, all right, guys, take five. The internet's down. and the client would be like, oh, you know, what can you do? You know, everybody understood that we're trying to do too much. We've outgrown the capabilities of the internet at this point, and we know it's going to get better, and we know the technology isn't there yet, but everyone was kind of just holding out for it. And
so when was that? What year was that when you guys were going through those kind of problems?
I'd say 2009. It just doesn't even seem that long ago, but
no.
The internet, you know, every year, the internet at your house, they're like, oh, you have, you know, a couple years ago you could get, the catchphrase was a T1 line. And now that's 1.5 megabits up. Now in my house I have 50. You know,
right.
T1 is a thing of the past, but it used to be a catchphrase.
Right.
And it's just extinct to get, you know, but I mean, we would go on site, and if the, you know, renting a satellite back then for internet connectivity was the most robust way, but it was $7,000 a day. So that broke the budget on a lot of shows, and they would just be like, oh, well, can you connect to this, you know, house that's next to this park? And we're like, yeah, sure. So we'd run a 1,000-foot Cat 5 cable to somebody's house and give them, like, a bunch of swag. We want for the Volcom event down at 54th Street, we literally ran a cable across the beach, probably 1,000 feet, and gave the guy on the corner of 54th Street, like, $1,000 credit to the Volcom store.
That is awesome.
He was psyched. He was psyched. And I mean, the guy was so rich. He's got like a $3 million house right on the beach, and he was psyched.
That's cool.
We were up in his living room, up top on the top floor, and trying to hook up to, you know, his router, and we had direct connection. It would still just, you know, it would just intermittently go out, and everyone understood, like, oh yeah, no, we're on a break. The internet's down. You know, we're working on it. And, you know, we would just keep shooting. We just keep the guys, the camera guys would get a break. We'd keep one guy on and we'd keep recording so that we had whatever, you know, happened in the water, we have it archived if something really cool happened.
Right.
But, I mean, archaic stuff was definitely going down. I can tell you, I probably shouldn't even tell you this, but I'm going to. the way we used to do replays, and we only did this for 1 year, but it was my friend Will's ingenious idea at Volcom. So when you know you watch a webcast, there's a little bit of a delay. There's like a 30-second delay. It depends on now. Actually, that delay is down to like 10 seconds, but back then it could be 30 seconds, could be a minute. Depends on your connectivity and the back end and how they're doing the encoding and all that process. But it's that 30-second delay that triggered this ingenious idea. So what we did was we took a computer screen and we draped a black tarp or like a cloth over it and put a camera in front of it. And it was about 2 feet away and fully framed, 16:9, and in focus and static and just sitting there. And it was looking at the webcast, which was delayed 30 seconds. So when something would happen in the water and it was sick and we wanted a replay, we had no replay machine at all. We would see that camera that was fixed on the webcast as an input in the machine. And that feed is our actual webcast feed that's delayed slightly. So if something sweet happened, we know that we have the opportunity to do a replay in 30 seconds from the webcast itself. So we would film the webcast and bring that back into the machine and show that live. So it was all the degraded quality of already going through the stream and then back into the switcher. But that's how we did replays. We knew that if we were going to do a replay, we had to do it in 30 seconds. There was no waiting.
Yeah, but that's not a bad way to do it. That actually works really well. That's
it did. It definitely did. But it was like if there was somebody on a wave in the water, it's like, do we cut away from the guy riding right now to the replay, or do we just never show the replay? Because once it's gone forever. It was pretty classic. It was pretty classic. And then the next year we stepped it up to a recording machine that somebody was sitting there hitting buttons. They still had no, you know, interface like they do now with the replay machine where you can see all your angles and you can edit a timeline and everything like that. But back then we were just stop, start, back like a VCR tape, but digital.
Yeah. Lo-fi. That's great.
There was a lot of technical challenges and growing pains. And you know, it's been really, really, really cool. I think the coolest thing about it is to watch it all, have watched it all develop. Because back then there was a lot of people in the marketing departments that we were working with that were saying, this is not going to work. There's no way this is going to work. This is going to die out. It's fad. It's clearly the technology isn't there.
Right.
This will never be like TV. And now look at, you know, you look at these WSL productions out in the middle of nowhere, and they're just blowing minds. It's just absolutely incredible.
It really is incredible. I mean, the production quality, and obviously, you know, they're mimicking or modeling a lot of other professional sports today, you know, particularly in the WSL. I think they're working with the stuff that already works well, and they've done a fantastic job of stepping up that game. So today with sort of the new technology, in terms of roles, when you're covering an event, you were talking about the director role. So the director is somebody who's sitting in front of a switchboard, and you said he's got all the camera angles in front of him. So is that person pretty much in charge of what we're seeing when we're watching a webcasted event?
You are. You're seeing their vision.
Yep.
They're yelling at the screen that has all the camera inputs and replay angles and all the different sources. And, you know, they're very, very animated people. They're, you know, using their hands and pointing at the screen and, you know, talking their jargon. And there's a language that they all adhere to, some kind of standard, and they all have their own variants of the language, but everybody in the truck or wherever the production's happening gets to know what they mean really quickly.
And this is all happening in real time. So they're talking about making these decisions right away. And is this like,
yeah, it's instant. It's so the language is, you know, basically if you're, there's seven camera operators, and then there's two inputs of replay that are, they call them either blue or red or alpha or beta, and they'll say camera one, ready one, take one, ready two, take two, ready three, dissolve three, ready beta on the replay, wipe to replay, and then ready two, out of replay with graphic, take two, and they're just yelling at the screen. And everybody who's tethered to that audio knows what to do. And they know when their job is up. And if you don't, you get yelled at. So,
did those guys who work, so are these guys that work for you, and did they come out of the video production world? They must have, right? They already know all the jargon and however.
It's a mix. It's a complete mix. Which is good because we have the grassroots people that came out of surfing into this and worked their way up. And we have the people who went to broadcast school and got into surfing. So there's a really cool medley of personality and skill sets. And, you know, you want to work with people that you can tolerate in small spaces for extended periods of time. So our crew is very core, and it's always this. It's 90% of the time the same crew, depending on the sport. If it's skateboarding, we have a certain crew for that, and there's some overlap. For surfing, there's a certain crew for that, and there's some overlap. You know, the most diverse position is probably the camera operators, and the camera operators have a very, very important role because they need to shoot the sport that we're covering in the respects that the core demographic covers it. So if we're shooting skateboarding and it's not being shot the way skaters shoot it, we're going to get called kooks. And then right. We look like corporate company trying to exploit them, and you'll just get booed off the stage. If you're shooting surfing and you're shooting it like skateboarding and just showing their legs, because in skateboarding you don't need to. You shoot them wide and then you zoom in on their feet because their feet is what's actually doing something. In surfing, you want to see a three-quarter shot. You want to see the wave height. You want to see what's ahead of them. You want to see what's behind them, and you want to see every maneuver and what's possible. If it's too tight, you don't know if the reason why he bailed or doggy doored out is because it was closing out. So you want to see if he bailed and it was a mistake because there was open face in front of him. So there's a certain way to shoot surfing and in a leading manner, and there's a certain way to shoot all these other sports. So, you know, these camera operators, they develop the skills, and some of them are just surf filmers. Some of them are just skate filmers, and some of them overlap. It's really interesting to see and watch my friends that do film develop their skills, get better, and become more comfortable with different stuff, because the more diverse you are, the more work you're going to get.
Right. So do you contract each event out? I mean, are you, in other words, do these camera operators and even the guys who work in the production booth or in the production truck, are these guys who work with you pretty consistently, or do you hire a team based on the event?
There's a core team that I have. It's like four or five guys, and they're the technical back end that I need in place no matter what we're doing.
Right.
And then there's the peripheral people. So you're going to think, okay, we're going to do this event. Who's going to be the director? So I have a couple directors, maybe three or four, that we are going to for specific sports. And then everybody else branching out, replay operators, encoding engineers for the internet, and camera operators, it's all on a per-case basis. And who's available? But the nature of the game is to build your schedule. So as a company, as Auxiliary Channel, my goal is to retain clients and then build on the schedule that we already have and repeat that schedule every year. So right now I know that next October 2nd, we're going to do the Pacific Paddle Games down at Doheny Beach. And all the guys that worked for me, 24 of them, that were there last week, no, they need to put that on their schedule, and 3-4 weeks out, if I haven't hit them up already, they hit me up and say, hey, are we on for this? And so they're actively building their schedule as well. And that's how it works. So, you know, everybody's trying to fill their schedule as much as they can, because everybody in nature is a freelancer in this business.
Right.
I mean, even the WSL they have their core crew of administrators, but all the camera operators are hired on a per event basis. I happen to be friends with most of the camera guys that work for the WSL, and I know for a fact they're not contracted for the year. They're contracted per event, and it's regionally whether or not they can afford to get somebody from, say, Hawaii to France. Maybe it's more affordable to get someone from Australia to France or from France to France if there's locals there. They obviously hire a very high caliber of personnel. So a lot of times they do spend the money to get someone really far to an event, but sometimes they don't. And so I can tell you that 90% of the people on that staff are freelancers, just like my guys are.
Wow, okay. Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the PPG because that's definitely obviously something we wanted to talk to you about. And so Roxanne and I were on the beach for the event. We were there for basically the whole week. And yeah, you guys did an incredible job covering the event. It was.
I wish I knew you were there.
I know. I'm realizing now, I'm like, oh gosh, I should have reached out to you. I should have put it together that you were there.
Yeah, I would have loved to show you the truck. It would have been cool. Next time.
Yeah, we'll be there next year again for sure. And then, you know, I saw, and you guys shot the PPG last year as well, right?
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. So anyway, fantastic job on both of those events. I mean, there's some different technicalities to covering it, right? You've got the kind of distance race, and then you got the technical race for the men and the women and so on. So tell us a little bit about that. Can you tell us a little bit about the transition from Battle of the Paddle to PPG, and maybe tell us a little bit about how you won that contract and kind of how that opportunity came to be?
This is the second year of the Pacific Paddle Games. And the first year, this organization that I work with, the Enthusiast Network, also known as TEN, is, I believe, the parent company for Trans World and a lot of different media outlets. They took over the event, and I've worked with them in the past on a lot of little surfing events. They actually control the small Volcom event that's down at Lowers now, the TCT Championships, and they do the NSSA Nationals in Huntington, and they do lots of other sports. They're a media company, so they have everything from car racing to everything. So I have a relationship with the Enthusiast Network. They took over the event, and they gave us the call. The challenges, the biggest challenge for that event is the budget. They want to do the best production they can do, but there's only so much budget to make it happen for the technical side and the crew side. So that's the biggest struggle with that event right now, and I won't go into details, but
right.
It's since they've taken it over, I think they did a fantastic with the event, especially on site. The presence of it is just, it's just a huge, it just seems like such a meaningful thing for all the people that are involved. And I get the vibe that it's definitely going to keep growing and gain momentum. And that's the goal. I think that, to be honest with you, stand-up paddling, in my eyes, is more of an Olympic sport than surfing. I don't know if that's a controversial subject or not, but I know that surfing's getting into the Olympics and skateboarding's getting into the Olympics in Japan. And I'm definitely going to go in 3 years or 4 years, whenever it is, and I think we all should. I think that'd be awesome. I've never been to Japan, and I'm going to the Olympics for sure. Surfing's in there, skating's in there, I'm going.
I'll come.
But just watching these guys and watching this community, it's such a family kind of vibe where the entire coastline is just laden with people screaming at, you know, the competitors. And it's like it just seems far more athletic than traditional surfing. Obviously, surfers have great bodies. They're definitely in shape, but I mean, you look at Chuck Patterson, he's a brick wall, and you know, he doesn't go to the gym. He just paddles a lot. Well, I can't say he doesn't go to the gym, but
right.
It looks, you know, a lot of these guys don't, and I've heard them in interviews, and they just say they're just training. Yeah. And to me, that it's just one of those sports. I think honestly that within the next, if not, you know, the next Olympics, cause they've already decided, but the Olympics following that, stand-up paddling will be in the Olympics. I can guarantee you that in our lifetime, if not very, very soon. Because they are amazing athletes. I mean, just the endurance and the physical ability that they're displaying is more than just surfing. It's actual athletic ability. And that's one of the things that we try to, you know, discuss with the announcers, and our producer Jody does a really, really, really good job of doing her homework and building announcer books for these guys when they're announcing this event, because when they come into the event, there's hundreds and hundreds of competitors that we're showing on the screen. There's no way they can know tidbits of information about each person except for that they're bib number 232,
right,
and they're from Dana Point because it,
right,
says it on the sheet. So they build out these announcer books where it literally is an encyclopedia. It's a very, very thick book of paper. And you can scroll through alphabetically and find people's names and get everything from every contest they've won to accolades and all their history right there in front of you. And it's awesome because any tidbit of information, especially regarding training and how serious they are about the sport, is one of the things that the announcers like to focus on.
Right.
Because it's motivating. It's motivating for the people watching it. It's like, wow, look at these people. Look how fit they are. Look what they're doing. I mean, it's like, to me, it looks like they're going to jump off their boards, run up the beach, grab a rifle, and shoot a target. It literally looks like they're on par for a triathlon. And we have a blast doing it. And it's, you know, I think that next year we'll have a little bit better a little bit more of a budget and do a little bit better of a job with certain aspects of the broadcast. But I think for what we had, we did a good job in showing, you know, and our goal is just to show how awesome these people are in the water. That's our goal, is making sure people at home realize that.
I mean, that came across loud and clear. So, I mean, as a guy who doesn't know anything about what's involved in the cost of putting on an event like that, or what it would even take to sort of have to scale it back based on shrinking budgets or what have you, it was invisible to us, you know, watching it from the web feed, and the final production was just incredible. And there's a lot to be said for also getting the right people in the booth doing commentary, you know, like having guys like Chuck Patterson and Dave Kalama and having those guys in there, those like industry veterans, builds huge credibility and authenticity. And so, you know, just the fact that you have their support and their names, you know, attached to the broadcast is outstanding. And I think in terms of the sport, you know, there's a lot of work that went into getting surfing into the Olympics, and that's very applaudable. I think you know, with all these Olympic sports, one of the key differences is you're either a judged event or you're judged by the clock. And
right
with surfing, it's going to be a judged event, like gymnastics or what have you. And then, but with stand-up paddle racing, you know, there's certainly some excitement around, you know, it's going to look like track and field. It's going to be a sprint, or it could be a long distance endurance run. Or I think a lot of the success that the race circuit has seen lately is with these dynamic courses, like what we saw with the technical race at PPG. I mean, that's where these guys really exhibit the amount of athleticism that some of these stand-up paddle racers have. And the Maui boys in particular, you know, you watch these young kids from Maui come in, and they can surf on a 22-inch wide, 14-foot race board so well, and they're just so perfectly poised and balanced on these very narrow boards, and it really separates themselves from these flat water racers who may have incredible performances and incredible results racing flat water, but as soon as you get them onto a technical course where they're going in and out with the surf, which is what spectators seem to really enjoy watching, it really separates kind of the level of athleticism and between, you know, people who know how to surf and people who don't. And so that's one of the most exciting things I think about the technical course.
Oh, completely agree. I completely concur with that statement. I think that having those buoys near surf is, and having surf in the contest is a complete catalyst into who wins the contest. We had good surf last year, and we had good surf this year. And Doheny's a great beach for that because it's a beach break, and they can move those buoys just a little bit to get closer. If the surf's a little smaller, they'll get a little closer to shore. If it's a little bigger, they'll bring them out. But they did a really, really good job with the course this year, and they changed a lot of things after watching last year's footage and seeing how the flow was. They got rid of a bunch of collision areas where they had some intersections of two-way flow for people that were way behind, and they rebooted the whole layout, and I think they did a killer job with the layout, and it definitely displayed the athleticism and the skill, that the separation of who can handle surf. I mean, I was there watching it, as you were. It blows my mind that they can dig the tail in like that and whip a 70-degree turn and just to stay on it and not even squabble. And the only thing that could take those Maui guys down is if someone hit them. And that happens. Rubbing is racing, and that's what the announcers were saying. They're like, right. You know, collisions happen, and unless it's completely deliberate, there's no penalty for it because you have a 14 or a 20-foot board. Or 14. How long are they? 14 feet?
Yeah, the 14 feet, yep.
14 feet, you can't say you can't touch people. It's not possible.
No, and all those guys, when they're going into the hammer buoy, which was the most entertaining buoy on the whole course, and for people who didn't see it, you got to catch it on YouTube or something. But, you know, they basically, as Brian pointed out, as you pointed out, they specifically position one particular buoy in near shore so that these guys have to round it while they're riding a wave. And so what you described is a perfect description of what it looks like. These guys have to come in on a whitewater wave, and on a couple of the days during the event this year, you know, they had some really nice shoulder high surf. And so you've got a pretty big, fair amount of water pushing you towards this buoy, and you're sharing this wave with four other guys. And you're approaching a buoy where you basically have to make almost, like a 160-degree turn. So you're almost a full 180. And just watching those guys and just how just athletic they are to be able to spin that, basically depress the tail and get around that buoy in a crowd with all that water was one of the most exciting things to watch in that race.
It certainly was. It was, I love surfing in the Olympics and skateboarding in the Olympics, but to me, this sport needs to be there. So I hope that having surfing be in the Olympics and them already having to parlay a water venue for the Olympics, it's so easy just to add this. I mean, it's just, okay, let's throw some buoys out there and get the organizers involved from the paddle world, and it's there. You don't have to build a mega stadium. You're using nature, and just throw some buoys out there, get the countries involved, and then you have a killer, killer presence. And I know that the stand-up paddle world is growing, and it's grown from, you know, the surfing side of stand-up paddling, where they started stand-up paddling big waves, and it's also growing from the aerobic and the gymnastic side of things, where people are doing yoga on stand-up paddle boards, and you have this whole fitness culture meeting the surfing culture, and it's a meld of two different, completely different worlds, but they're perfectly balanced because you're using water as the medium. And these different worlds are colliding, and that's where we're at now. I think stand-up paddle, the paddle games in particular, is showing that balance. But also, you have to know how to surf. You can't just go out there and be a flatwater power racer because you got to bang a 130, 150-degree turn in shore break. So I think that the future of the sport is yet to be seen. And I think it's just going to continue to be more and more exciting. I think it's going to really catch up to the surfing world And, you know, it's hard to say, but in the near distant future, I think it's going to surpass it because it's way more, it's far easier for the common person to grasp this as, or embrace this as a sport that they can do versus someone who's watching Chopu at home. Like, my mom would never, ever consider going out on a day of Chopu. But she would definitely look at stand-up paddling and go, okay, I can't do that, but I can stand on it, and I can probably get around. Yeah. And you, so you're going to have a way bigger audience in the end.
Yeah, a lot more people. I agree.
Yeah, it's just
a lot more people
really
identify.
To see where it's going.
It really is. No, I agree. And it's just so much. It's very identifiable to a lot of people because it's, there's just so much flat water out there. There's all kinds of different possibilities in terms of where people can paddle, whether it's lakes,
yeah,
whether it's streams, ocean, what have you.
It's amazing.
But so Brian, I want to talk to you a little bit about, I want to go back to the surf world
sure,
for a second. And one of the things that Kevin and I definitely wanted to cover with you was some of your experience working with the ASP. And,
okay,
and maybe a good lead into that would be, it'd be great to hear your perspective on sort of, but we definitely want to hear about your coverage of the Fiji event. But maybe if you just want to start by talking a little bit about, from your perspective, sort of what kinds of things happened when the World Tour changed from the ASP to the WSL and how that came about.
Sure. The Fiji event was an incredible opportunity that was offered to me by the company that I previously mentioned, UTMG, Uncle Toad's Media Group, who used to do a lot of the ASP tour stops. They were taking on this Fiji stop for the first time, and the Fiji stop hadn't happened for several years. And now the level of webcasting was so high that the expectations were there to, you know, maintain what was already happening and not have to see any suffer with the fact that we're out on a tower a mile and a half from the main island. So the task was to, you know, have cameras everywhere and to the people at home not appear that there was a link of water that was a mile and a half away. So
Brian,
Brian,
I know you had some challenges there too, because and I want you to kind of discuss that. Like, maybe I remember getting a text during that event, and I was watching the event, especially when the swell picked up. And I remember getting a text from you, and it said, "Kev, you know, I'm scared for my life, and you know, this is getting dangerous out here." So maybe if you could just like touch on that and the difficulties when the swell did get big, and what you and your team had to basically take on during that event.
Oh yeah, the challenge was to get all this gear onto the tower. And that's, you know, part of the challenge was to keep the level of production as good as it was. So we have all this incredibly heavy gear that usually gets trucked around, is now gonna somehow get onto the top floor of the tower that's on six telephone poles and a two-story, it's basically a heavy-duty scaffolding that's out on a reef. The challenge with the getting gear onto the tower is there's a special tide that a certain time of tide that allows you to get that gear onto the tower. Low tide, it's dry reef. High tide, the waves make it, they make it to the tower with too much power that you can't get off a boat onto the tower. It's too dangerous because the tidal rise with the waves is 10 feet. You smash up against the underside of the tower. So, you know, we had 7 days to set the event up, and during those days, it's mellow because you just know at 1 o'clock you're going to the tower, and you have about a half an hour of a window to get up there with all that gear. So the first 7 days were fine. We go out there and we have a boat, and it, you know, we had a winch, and you lower the winch cable down, you get the gear, and you get it up through the hole, and it's still dangerous. You still have to be very careful and not lose a finger. But, you know, the first 7 days were okay. Well, the challenge that we had the day you're referring to is the day before, at the end of the day, the Volcom guys were like, hey, we're going to run restaurants tomorrow. It's looking perfect for restaurants. We're not doing Cloud Break. So we actually have to physically move the production from the tower to the island and set up for restaurants. And for all those that are listening that don't know the difference between the Fiji stop has two potential waves. Cloud Break, which is the main event where you see the tower in the background, and that's a mile and a half from shore. And then restaurants is a wave that actually breaks outside of Tavarua. And in all respect, they still have to deal with that to this day. They still have to deal with the day-to-day, hey, where's it going to be? And the WSL has run at restaurants in the last couple of years at the turn of the hat. But this particular day, they decided that they were going to run at restaurants. So we spent the afternoon into the night changing, getting all the gear off the tower in less than ideal tide, and getting it back to restaurants, and then we set up restaurants. We got everything all set up and tested and went to bed. Woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and they go, we're running Cloud Break. You got to bring it back to Cloud Break.
Oh, no way.
So we had just transferred the entire setup from the tower back to land, and now we had to go rush in the dark to get it on the tower. And it didn't matter what the tide was. You just had to get it on the tower.
And
there
was
no waiting, and there was no, you know, there was no logical thinking at this point. It was get it on the tower, get it up and running as fast as you can. We know we're not going to go live at 8 o'clock. And hopefully we'll be live at 9 o'clock, but it's absolutely ideal right now, and we need to be up and running as soon as we can.
Brian,
so we went out to the tower.
Brian, how big was, how big was the surf at this point?
I mean, it was 20, 25 foot.
Wow.
It was absolutely, I could not believe my eyes.
So
and I couldn't see it at first because we were working in the dark and I could just hear it. And the boat was, when we were on the reef, the whole reef was shaking. The whole boat was shaking. Every time those waves broke, you could feel it completely. It rattles the tower. It's not the waves hitting the tower that rattles the tower. It's the reef shaking.
Wow.
It's the actual vibrations that that hit it first.
Why do you think these guys were indecisive about where they wanted to hold the event?
Just because of the forecast, and then, you know, they're going to bed, and everybody who knows that wave and all the locals are saying it's going to be restaurants, it's going to be restaurants, and whatever, you know, Mother Nature decided it's not. I mean, restaurants was good, but Cloud Break was epic. So that was the thing. It's like, oh, do we run restaurants? And everyone's going to find out the Cloud Break was epic and deal with the ridicule. Or,
yeah.
You know, so that was the toss-up. And they decided, let's go to this, you know, let's do Cloud Break. So we had to get the gear on the tower. And the tide was way too high for it. And, I mean, I couldn't even tell what the tide was because the water would subside down to a couple feet above the reef, and you could see the reef, and then all of a sudden you're 12 feet in the air because of the white water that just came through. And we're trying to get the gear on the tower with these dinghies, and these boats they're like 20 foot open hull wooden boats with a 30 horsepower outboard motor on the back that the local Fijian is holding on with dear life. He's holding onto the motor and holding onto the stick and trying to work the gas forward and backwards, but it's really ineffective with those kind of waves. You're at the mercy of the sea. So we got some of the gear onto the tower. One of the guys almost got chopped in half because he was leaning over the bow, and this wave came, and everyone yells, wave, 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 and you're supposed to duck down because the boat actually rises up and smashes into the underside of the tower.
Oh, my God.
If you're hanging over the boat and you go up and hit it'll just decapitate you without hesitation. It'll take your hands off, take your arm off, take your head off, whatever. So we had a really, really near miss, and then I was like, oh, man. That's when it really hit me. I was like, I knew this was dangerous, but I just watched that, and now I'm like, this is real. You got to really watch your butt, because you can end up not going home from this. And it's all in the name of getting the webcast up as fast as you can. And we got people on the radio going, how's it going? How's it going? Hurry up, hurry up. So,
wow.
At one point, the driver was like, no more, no more, no more. We can't do this. It's too dangerous. And he just pulled plug. So we're like, oh, man, trying to call back to the tower to the island and tell these guys, hey, the driver's saying this, we can't do it. There's no, it's not happening. So we came up with another plan, and that was to get jet skis over there and put small amounts of gear on the jet ski and zip over when there was a lull and throw the stuff up onto the tower.
So in and out from the channel?
Exactly.
Okay.
We're behind the tower.
Gotcha.
So the further you go away from the tower, away from the wave, the larger the distance you put yourself between the wave and the tower, the smaller the white water is, because it's rumbled over the reef. So we went probably 500 yards behind the tower and camped out in this guy's, his 20-foot boat. And then the jet ski would come over, grab a person and a bag or a camera, and zip over the little dock area at the tower. And then there was a couple guys on the tower that would grab the stuff real quick. Wow. And so, like, I'm just like white face at this point, and I just have bad luck with this stuff. I'm very careful and very thorough what I do, but I just have bad luck, and I gained the nickname Short Circuit for that reason. But the first jet ski I got on, they try to do a three-man ride where the driver, it was like the Red Bull driver guy, and then there was an IT guy who had his laptop and a thing in his hand, and I'm on the back. And as soon as I get on the jet ski, we get hit by a wave, and it just capsizes. Oh. It just flips over, and now I'm in the water, like, just I got a leg in the water. I actually, like, kind of ninja'd out of it. The driver and the other guy bailed. They're in the water. And I, like, kind of felt the roll coming and dove back towards the boat. So I was kind of like, I got like a foot in the water and half in the boat, and the guys grabbed me and pulled me back in the boat. So I avoided going in the water. But now the jet ski's flipped over, and it's drifting away. And I was just like, oh, my God, this is insane. Long story short, we got all the gear onto the tower, and we're just having technical problems one after another, because everything's just happening so fast. We're getting yelled at. They went live to the world at 9 o'clock with the announcers and, like, a recap from yesterday, and they're killing time. They had the wireless shot from the boat and the long lens from the island. And they're doing a little production around that, going, all right, we're going to get it going. It's really, really good. But we can't start until we have the two long lens cameras on the tower, because those are the two main angles. And then all of that other stuff, all the communication, links through the tower. So the tower wasn't up and running, and they were waiting for us. And we tried our absolute damnedest, and it took till probably, I think it was maybe 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning before we were up and running. Wow. And it was just a big sigh of relief. We're up and running, and no one got hurt. And they ran, I forget now, but they ran probably, I don't know, an hour and a half, 2 hours of heats. And then they just decided it was too big. I don't know if you guys remember this, but
they
called the contest off, but Volcom decided to broadcast the free surf, because all of the big wave guys had heard that it was going to go off. So they were all in town, and they were all out there on the waiting boat, waiting for them to get done with the day or call it off or whatever. So as soon as it was done, you have, like, Greg Long and Jamie Sterling jumping in the water, and they're just there ready to go. And so we broadcast for, like, 3 hours of free surf, no contest, but all the announcers stayed in the booth and announced it. We did replays and recaps, and they just – it was – the most awesome decision, and I love Volcom for doing it, because I don't know any other company that would have done it. Spending the money and paying the crew to stay out there and broadcast a day of big wave surfing, and ultimately was like epic and super legendary. I go back and watch it every now and then. It's still archived, and I love it. I mean, I got to film on the top of the tower. One of the camera operators took a break, and I got on a 100x lens and shot for 2 hours. And a lot of those, I mean, when I watch that, I can see which angle is mine. And I was an engineer, so I was on the tower as an engineer, and I got the camera operate for several hours on that shoot, and I was shaking. I was just like, I can't believe I'm filming this. I couldn't even believe humans were doing that. I was just blown away. And then I get to go back to the island that night and hang out with them. It was just like,
wow.
It was one of the most incredible. I literally don't think I said a word the whole day. I was just dumbfounded. It was a lot to absorb. It was an emotional day with very, very dangerous morning and an incredible afternoon. And it all made it worth it in the end, you know?
Oh, it was all definitely worth it. And kudos to you guys for like sticking with it in some insanely high pressure situation, dealing with like risk of life and then having the whole event basically waiting for you guys to get set up. That had to be intense. But in the end, I mean, think about all the work that went into that. But in the end, you guys were able to capture one of the most epic days that reef has probably seen in a long time. And I remember reading stories about all those big wave guys going over there and all of their friends saying, what are you doing? They're going to be running a contest. There's no way you're going to get in the water because they're going to be running heats the whole time. And they were going over there anyway because they were just like, I have to go. It's a legendary, massive swell. This is what I do, and I'm going. And so it was really, really cool that those guys were literally sitting in the channel waiting for an opportunity. And who knows what kind of side deals or things were going on between them and the ASP guys, right? But for them, for their window to open up and still have plenty of daylight, and you guys already positioned, like after doing all that work, you guys are positioned on the tower, you got all your gear, you're ready to roll. I mean, what an awesome opportunity to be able to capture one of the most amazing big wave events in probably our lifetime. Right? I mean, outstanding.
It was. I mean, we were set up with, like, you know, two wireless boat angles, 200x lenses on the tower. It was fully ready to go, you know? So it was just the perfect layup to that. And, you know, we had the great announcers and a great team, and everything was up and running. So those guys got all the free surfers had a serious bonus to their session.
How's like for you?
Go back and watch.
How's
oh
like,
man, I was.
I mean, how, I was, many, I, how many times do you get to run the camera?
I never get to run camera anymore. Ever.
So did you have a good time?
That might have been the last time I ran camera. I'd never get to do it. It's just not something that falls into my lap. So
after that, everything else looks so substandard that, you know, running camera for that kind of event. That's like,
Yeah.
That's
my retirement.
That's your swan song. Yeah.
If it's not 25 feet, I'm not shooting it.
I guess you're not videoing me anytime soon then. But hey, Bright, I just have a question about kind of nowadays with the WSL, because, you know, the Cloudbreak event is still going on, obviously. And do they set up both Cloudbreak and restaurants now with camera gear, or are they still having to move it from location to location depending on the size of the swell and the swell direction, you know, all that?
Well, the production where they actually have the director and the brain of the operation is on the island. The link, there's a lot of technology that's on the tower that links the tower to land, and that's the two long lens broadcast cameras and then all the communication to the boats and everything out in the water. And those wireless links from the jet skis and the dinghy come back to the tower and then relay back to the island. So when they run restaurants, yeah, they do have to repo a lot of stuff. They're, you know, the scaffolds are all built and everything like that, but they have to move those cameras. And, you know, nowadays, maybe, because I haven't been there in the last couple years, but now maybe even from the stories that we had to deal with, they just budget in extra gear and have it, because it's pretty dangerous, and there's a possibility it might not happen. I mean, if the tide is really wrong and the waves are really big, the Fijian boat drivers are there for your safety, and they're going to tell you no. They're going to go, no, that you can't go. And I remember one guy, one of the boat drivers, I forget his name, it was like Rugi or something, and he would always do the shaka, and he was missing a finger, and it was because of that. It was, wow. He lost it, he slammed it on the edge of the boat, and it snapped off in the tower, and he would do the shaka minus one finger every time.
It's more like a thumbs up then?
Yeah, exactly. He would say like, "Hey, it's dangerous," and you would do the shaka with missing fingers. So, they're out there to make the call. And don't get me wrong, those dudes are gnarly. They are gnarly. They bring you out there into some conditions where you're like, "Are you sure this is okay?" And they're like, "Yeah, you're good. I'll let you know when it's not."
Wow.
So they know the water better than anybody, and they'll get you there if they can. But there's days where they say they can't. So I wouldn't be surprised if they double dutied it nowadays and had restaurants ready to go. I don't know.
I think you guys are lucky, and I think that I think all of you guys are lucky that nobody got hurt there, because that could have been set a really different tone on the day, obviously, if something like that were to happen. And I think that, you know, the fact that this was the first time that you'd really seen conditions like this, not you personally, but the whole event had seen conditions like this. You know, I think that it was easy to keep your foot on the gas and say, we got to get this. But in hindsight, I'm sure if they ever saw this again, there might be some speculation or maybe even some doubt about how fortunate they were that they got, that everything went well when it did. Because if you try to do it again, I think the risks are just too high.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the Vulcan guys just, they had no idea what we were dealing with, because they're in the control room on land, and they're just like biting their nails, you know, when are we going to be up and running? When are we up and running? They don't, and they know we're out on boats and dealing with that. And they just, you know, they just figure that it'll get done. And, unless you're out there and you're dealing with it, you realize that there's a chance it might not happen. And we were trying not to relay that to them, because everyone was so pumped on the waves, and there was just no coming back from it. So we never once were like, this isn't going to happen. We knew that the boat wasn't going to get us to the tower. So that's when we were like, all right, how are we going to get to the tower? We have to do something else. And that's where the jet skis came in. So the whole time we were 100%. We're like, we're going to make this happen somehow. I mean, even if we don't get all the gear up there, we'll get up there and we'll get the link going between the wireless cameras and land and get something going. So,
well, that's what makes you guys so special, right? Is that whole can-do attitude. And that's, I mean, I gotta think that Volcom really appreciated having the right guys in that position at that time, because, yeah, I mean, how psyched were you to be able to cover all that and be able to get the shots of one of the most epic days ever? And there's no way you're gonna say, hey, this isn't gonna happen. We gotta pull the plug. You gotta do everything you can to try to get that done.
Yeah, it was a wild day, one that I will never forget, and I'm so fortunate that it's archived online. Gotta love it. You know, that's the love for the technology that I'm working with, and just that archive of these memories, and be able to go back and do it. And you know, Vulcan ran that event. They ran that event. They hired the production company and us to come out there and to do it, and now it's all the WSL, but I got to give it up to, you know, the old model where the companies were taking on these productions by themselves, and now, you know, that's all changed to, you know, an in-house operation where the company's involvement is very, very limited, more of just like a sponsor of it, and the WSL handles the functionality of the broadcast completely, it's you know, I haven't been a part of any of these new WSL events, because they're all, you know, in-house, and they work with one production company as far as the equipment providing, and they keep it all in-house as far as engineers and everything like that. So I haven't had an opportunity to work on in one of them, but it's a very well-oiled machine. As you can see, they kind of went to a formulaic model versus having different graphics packages for every event. They have a universal package now, and it changes with just the slight different branding with each event.
Gotcha. So that's the key difference, huh? So in the old days, the sponsors would really kind of run the show and run the production, whereas now WSL is running the production.
Exactly. It was 100%, you know, that Fiji event was ran by Volcom 100%, and the ASP was, you know, more of just like the governing body of surfing that was taking these feeds and promoting them, because it was their athletes and their tour. So the change for them to get involved with the broadcast was a big change. It was a very big change.
Hmm. Yeah.
They're still, you know, still working out the kinks.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, all of us who get to watch these events, from the comfort of our homes, of our TVs or computers or whatever, we just wanted to say how much we appreciate everything that you guys do to make it possible. And all of us who go back and watch the archive of that Fiji event, we should all keep in mind, hopefully everyone who's seen that event is going to listen to this interview, because I think it adds a whole different type of texture to understand what went into providing all that footage. So thanks, Brian.
Oh, thank you. We're blessed to have the opportunity to do it. And we're glad that people like to watch it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's no shortage of people in that category, that's for sure. So what's next for you and Auxiliary Channel? What are you guys up to?
The next thing we're doing is we're doing a skateboard event. The Tampa Am is upon us. It's the 23rd annual Tampa Am at the skate park of Tampa.
Great.
And that's November 11th and 12th and 13th.
Awesome. And so how many years have you guys been covering that?
We'll be covering that for 9 years.
Wow.
And we do the Tampa Am and the Tampa Pro. The Tampa Pro is in March, and Tampa Am. It's the 23rd annual Tampa Am, the 24th year of the skate park at Tampa. They're like, you know, family to us at this point. The guy that runs the skate park over there and started it, Brian Schaefer, is like a brother of mine. And I got to give big ups to Brian for giving us the opportunity way back when, you know, it was a distant idea, and now it's a full-on production. So we have a lot of fun out there. Tampa's like a little time warp bubble where anything goes once you're in those gates. free tattoos to endless PBR. It's wow. Pretty fun. So that's what's up. That's the next thing.
Awesome. Well, good luck in Tampa. Have a great time. And thank you, Brian. We really, again, appreciate you taking the time to talk to us this morning. This has been an amazing interview. Really appreciate everything you had to share today. And just want to say congrats on everything you've done, and good luck continuing to do amazing work. And please stop in if you're ever in this neck of the woods and say hello again when you get a chance.
Of course. Thanks to the Wind and Waves crew. I love you guys. You guys are amazing. Honestly, when I saw Chuck Patterson last week, I told him that I said hello to, and he kind of looked at me like he recognized me from the year before, from, you know, the techie guy. And then I told him I knew you guys, and he lit up with a smile. He was like, oh, all right, we're bros. Awesome. So, you know, you get kudos to what you guys have done and what you're doing.
Yeah.
A lot of respect there.
Chuck is like family. He's a great guy, and we've been fortunate to spend a lot of time with him. We really, really love that guy a lot. And I know that you brought his name up earlier, but I will say that every time I call that guy, he tells me he's at the gym. So don't be thinking he's not working out. That guy always seems to be at the gym, and certainly shows like he's an animal, but we love him. We love him a lot. So
I'm glad you got to see him.
That's great.
I'm glad that he goes to the gym, because if he looked like that and didn't, I would have just been so sad about my genetics.
He's got a pretty awesome genes, I'll say that.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks, Brian.
Thank you, guys.